Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio. Hey, what?
There's been a lot of deal making out there, a lot of big deals made, but one that has come apart involves the unfortunately named, I think we can all agree, Trunk and Tribune and all of the things associated with those media properties. We want to make sense of it all, so we're turning to a couple of experts. Todd Shields, he's our FCC reporter down in Washington. He joins us there from our Bloomberg 99.1 studio. And here in New York, in our Bloomberg 1130 studio, we have Brooke Sutherland. She's, of course, deals and industrials columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. So, Todd, I want to start with you. $1 billion suit was filed against Sinclair by Tribune. What does this all mean? How did this come to a head?
Hi. Well, it's the tail end of what's been a long struggle here for both companies, it turns out. Sinclair last year proposed to buy Tribune Media, which is distinct, I have to say, from Trunk. Trunk
right.
owns newspapers, and they're not part of this deal. Tribune Media owns a bunch of TV stations and a big cable channel, and that's what Sinclair wanted to buy to become a really big broadcaster. The deal's been in trouble here in Washington for a long time. Troubles accelerated last month when the FCC sent it to a hearing that could last possibly years, Tribune said in a filing today. Could delay the merger for years. So Tribune pulled the plug rather than suffer further.
Right. And I should be clear. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah. Trunk and Tribune are distinct companies. And yet, Brooke Sutherland, you write in a very smart
both
column
in the news.
That they're both in the news for different reasons, obviously. And they may, you say, in your piece, may get the last laugh after some very tough goes of it.
Yes, difficult circumstances. I'll start with Trunk. So they had that very high-profile takeover battle with Gannett, which was back in 2016, actually. And they pretty much just had a just-say-no defense. They pulled out every trick in the book. They brought in a white knight investor. They had all of these, you know, just awful corporate governance practices that essentially prevented this deal from getting done, along with Gannett's bankers pushing back on the valuation. And this company has sort of been floundering a bit since. It's had a lot of different scandals, I guess, if you want to say it, in terms of its management of the newsrooms at the papers that it owns. It is not beloved by the employees, I think is safe to say. Chairman Michael Farrow, who was really the architect of this just say no defense against Gannett, had to step down amid sexual harassment allegations. He tried to sell his stake in the company, but that deal ultimately fell through. And now there's a report that Trunk might sell itself to a private equity firm at a really high price, especially considering that the company has already sold off the LA Times to its second biggest investor, Patrick Soon-Shiong.
Which was an amazing turn of events in and of itself, because he was essentially thrown off the board, right?
Yes, he was kicked off the board, accused of being disruptive. There were some questions about trades that he made and in Trunk's stock. And he was also accused by Trunk of angling to buy the LA Times. And they said they're not interested in doing that unless he makes a bid for the whole company, obviously that's not exactly
and
what
then they
happened.
Sold them the LA Times and not the rest of the company.
Yes, exactly.
Amazing.
Oh, my
amazing.
God. All these moving parts. So, all right, as we've made some distinctions between Tronc and Tribune, Todd, let's go back to Tribune for a moment. So Tribune has filed this suit against Sinclair, and it has to do with questioning kind of Sinclair's honesty. What's the legal grounds for this? Where are regulators going to be on this?
Well, we're waiting to see what the regulators do. The Justice Department has said basically nothing in public about this deal. The FCC sent it to that possibly lengthy hearing, and Sinclair this afternoon said, we want to withdraw from that hearing. We're going to withdraw the application at the FCC and withdraw from the hearing. Let's see what the FCC says about this. There are some who are saying the FCC should examine Sinclair, whether it's worthy to hold a license.
What did they do
forward.
Wrong?
Well, according to Tribune, the problem was that Sinclair, according to the suit, Sinclair pursued, if you will, a maximalist strategy before regulators, which slowed things way down. The regulators at the Justice Department, according to Tribune, said, sell these 10 stations. Sell stations in these 10 markets. Excuse me. I'll put it that way. And we'll clear you. And Sinclair wouldn't take yes for an answer, if you will. Let me read just a little something from a complaint by Tribune. They say Sinclair breached its contractual obligations to finish up the deal quickly. Quote, in spectacular fashion. Now, you don't often see, I don't think, that in legalese. You know, it's spectacular. So here, a little bit more, and then I'll stop. Sinclair engaged in belligerent and unnecessarily protracted negotiations with regulators, says Tribune. So that's the basis of it. They say, look, we were left standing at the altar for a very long time because you, Sinclair, weren't doing it right. And, of course, Sinclair rejects it and says they're going to defend vigorously in court.
I think what's so striking to me about this, though, is that the regulatory environment was welcoming to this deal.
Right.
You know, the
yeah.
FCC changed. I mean, they didn't change, but they took advantage of a regulatory loophole to allow Sinclair to go beyond the media ownership limits. And they really, I mean, they couldn't have held the door open any wider. And Sinclair just seems to not have been able to get out of its own way. And you read these reports, they were trying to sell stations to a business affiliate of their chairman, to a company that was affiliated with his family. I mean, this is all things that should be obvious that you shouldn't do when you're trying to get regulatory approval for a deal that's already rather contentious.
Right, and especially when regulators were kind of, as you said, opening the door for them to kind of get it done. All right, so what's next? Just quickly, Todd Shields, 10 seconds. What's the next thing that we have to watch out for in the Tribune Sinclair suit?
Well, we wait to see Sinclair's next move. They say they might still be in the market to do some transactions. We wait to see if the FCC lets them off the hook.
And what about you, Brooke? What are you watching with this kind of trifecta of companies?
I'm watching to see what happens with Tribune Media and whether another buyer comes along. If you remember back when they had the deal negotiations, Nexstar Media was in the mix, was really going toe-to-toe with Sinclair for a while. A couple of private equity firms were interested. Also, Fox and Blackstone contemplated a bid. So there could be another deal here.
In love with media, not in love with media. In love with traditional media or whatever. Cool stuff. Thank you guys so much for providing some clarity to all of this. Todd Shields, our FCC reporter at Bloomberg News, back in our 99.1 studio in the nation's capital. Brooke Sutherland, deals and industrials columnist at Bloomberg Opinion, in our New York studio. Check them both out at Twitter. You are listening to Bloomberg Markets. Carol Master, Jason Kelly, right here on Bloomberg.
It is so bad when you finally know just how low, 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 low she's bad, bad thing.
All right, everybody. That's what the United States is saying to Russia. You did a bad, bad thing. And, of course, we know the U.S. imposed some sanctions on Russia. Now the Russia is coming back, threatening to do the same. Let's get into this with our Matthew Phillips, policy and politics editor at Bloomberg Business Week from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Hey, Matthew, good to have you here with Jason and myself. I know we love to kind of round up Washington with you. And this story, the sanction battle between the U.S. and Russia, I'm having a hard time getting my head around, because I just go back to the Helsinki meeting between Trump and Putin when they seemed like buddies, and now we're fighting. Make some sense of it.
You're not the only one who's feeling a little bit of whiplash here. Those of us in Washington, as well as I'm sure plenty of people in Moscow, too. Remember, this is not even a month off from the Helsinki summit. The Russians thought everything was going nice. Things were on track. Putin thought it was quite successful. He was actually, you know, there's this sense of gloating almost about it. And then all of a sudden, the mood has gone 180 degrees in the other direction, turned dramatically here. Specifically, what we saw get announced from the State Department yesterday is in response to the nerve agent attack on former spy Sergei Skripal in the UK back in March. These are required under a 1991 law that mandates the punishment of countries that use chemical weapons. They've only ever been used against North Korea and Syria. So this is a pretty big deal. There are two components here. One goes into effect in August, on August 22nd, limit the exports to Russia of U.S. goods and technology considered sensitive on national security grounds. The second, which are much more sweeping, may follow in November, just a couple of days before the election, in fact. Those would include a downgrading in diplomatic relations, bans on import of Russian oil and exports, and all other goods and technology. And the question here really is, to your point up at the top, is about timing. And why, if these were landed in response to an attack that happened back in March, why are we getting these things right now? And two things to remember. One, these happened almost 2 weeks after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had a very testy hearing in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about the administration's position toward Russia. He got grilled. He was visibly angry. This also comes on the heels of a bill introduced last week that it took a while for the market and really the rest of us to catch up to it. And those were introduced by Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina. Very draconian. It would limit U.S. entities from buying Russian debt. It targets some of its largest banks. It could even lead to the labeling of Russia as a state sponsor of terror. So you wonder about the timing here from a political standpoint from the White House, whether there's anything to be said about them feeling like Congress was maybe getting out in front of them on that.
So, Matthew, I know we have been hearing not just about Russia, but also Iran this week when it comes to sanctions. So put those in context for us. I know they're obviously separate issues, but it feels like, you know, there's Shark Week and now it's sanctions week.
Sanctions year, maybe. I mean, look, the Trump administration has clearly found something that it feels is quite effective, whether you're talking about companies or countries, in pulling the sanctions lever. In specific relation to Iran, obviously these are in reaction to Trump pulling out of the nuclear accord in May. And we're also going to get two components of that, too. We're going to get some that hit earlier this week that had to do with the gold market and Iranians' access to dollars. And then we get in November, again, November seems to be kind of the time when we get some of these things, sanctions that are aimed at really the lifeblood of the Iranian economy, which is their oil sector. So there is, you know, look, Trump has clearly, he campaigned on this. Mm. It's part of something that I feel like they probably feel like previous administrations, especially the Obama administration, maybe didn't use to their full advantage, which is the power of the United States as a market and as a force around the world. And when you put this test to companies, you know, the interesting thing about the Iranian sanctions is that Europeans are not on board with this, and yet their companies have a stark choice to make here. You either do business with the United States or you do business with Iran. You may not do both. And obviously, it's a much more lucrative market for them to do deals with the U.S., so the choice is obvious for them.
Matthew, very quickly, I mean, sanctions come under the Treasury Department, which comes under Steven Mnuchin, which is the cover of Bloomberg Businessweek. That's kind of a cheap plug, but I'm going to do it anyway. But is Mnuchin behind all of this? Just quickly.
Well, you know, that is a really interesting question because on the one hand, he seems to have been very engaged on the sanctions front. Some of the details we get out of that story was how interested he's been in learning kind of all the power that resides within Treasury sanctions front. But then, you know, we also have a sense that at least as it relates to what the Congress is putting out there, that this is something the Treasury was not in favor of, and especially limiting access to Russian debt. So.
Yeah.
I mean, look, he's obviously got friends on Wall Street that are telling him one thing, that this is going to be bad for the market, but then he's a survivor, and he wants to maintain his good graces with the president, so he's going along with it.
All right, we got to run. Matthew Phillips of Bloomberg Businessweek, policy and politics editor from Washington.
Oh, it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
A lot of swinging going on out in St. Louis starting today and through Sunday. It, of course, is the PGA Championship. And one golfer who continues to fascinate is Tiger Woods. And we're going to bring in a guy who knows a little bit about Tiger. That is Dan Murphy. He's the CEO of Bridgestone Golf. He is based down in Covington, Georgia. I was teasing him about not having not quite a Southern accent, but I see some hints of it, hear some hints of it here and there. But he is here with us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. Dan, great to have you with us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
So the PGA obviously is this week. It's going on right now. Tiger, I believe, even par. He's finished for the day. You got a chance to spend some time with him at your named tournament, I believe, last weekend. So how's he doing?
He's doing great. Yeah, we had the Bridgestone Invitational in Akron, Ohio. It's played at Firestone Country Club. And so it was my first time. I'm just back with the company about 6 weeks. It was my first time to meet him. And it was just, it was amazing.
Why?
Well, you know, I've been around a lot of pros, Freddie Couples and Brant Snedeker, Matt Kuchar, all of our other guys. But being with Tiger, it's just a different, it's a different league. I had those butterflies in my stomach. I was careful of what I said. It's a little bit like being on your radio right now.
Oh, no. We're easy. We're easy.
We're much nicer than Tiger.
No, but you think about, you know, we've often talked here on Bloomberg about how a younger generation not necessarily so interested in golf. But, you know, when you put Tiger on, you put him on in a tournament, the viewership goes up. People get interested and engaged again.
The whole equation changes, it feels like.
Yeah.
Well, completely. In the equation, that's a great, good way to put it. All of our metrics go off the charts when he's playing.
What do you mean specifically?
Well, I mean, our website visits go way up. Our direct consumer sales go way up.
No kidding. It's that noticeable.
Oh, absolutely. And he's the one guy, really, that does that. You know, we have a lot of pros. I've been in the business for a very long time, and you build your brand around the pros. But it's always a little bit difficult to see the cause and effect. With Tiger, you do.
You guys picked him up, too, after Nike dropped him, correct?
Correct.
Tell me why you were willing to do that. When someone has said, it's a tarnished brand.
Well, no, I don't, because he's still Tiger Woods and he still moves the needle and he's still the best player that's ever walked the face of the earth. So to have him choose, and quite honestly, we certainly.
You pitched him?
Well, no, he came to us because you know that he knows that we have the best product in the business. And he tested a lot of products his analysis said we have the best product. And so he came to us and we said, well, sure, if the best player in the history of the game wants to play our product, that's probably a good thing.
And what is the business like right now? I mean, Carol alluded to the fact that, you know, you do hear these kind of existential threat stories around golf, especially as a younger generation comes up. But what do you see as you look at your numbers, as you walk the courses? Is it not as bleak would think? I think I know your answer, but go on.
It's not all doom and gloom. We see it being very, very steady. Some of the parts of the market, with millennials even, which is, it's hard to get millennials to settle down and play 18 holes of golf.
Especially when they're playing video games and esports and all that stuff.
Right, right. I mean, we see an entry into the game with Topgolf, if you ever heard of that.
Yeah,
sure.
It's essentially a bowling alley adapted to a driving range. And so we see a lot of millennials making the jump from that, which is very active, and actually coming onto the golf course and giving it a try for real.
Dan, I am wondering what you're doing. Like, I grew up in a golf family. My dad was a golfer. My four brothers were a golfer. It's just the way it was, kind of a rite of passage, you know. I'm just curious what you guys are, though, doing to get to that younger audience that you hopefully hook them and have them for decades.
Well, I think we have to have new approaches to the game. You know, the traditional 18 holes is a lot of time commitment, even for me now. And I am a baby boomer and of that normal target market for golf. But to expand our target market, I think we have to make golf more fun, invite some of the lifestyle elements that millennials want to see, allowing music on the course, allowing more of a casual dress, and welcoming that, not just allowing it, really, and creating an experience where they can play this great game, but they can do it maybe in a shorter time frame.
And it is, as we mentioned, the week of the PGA, and we will have live coverage of the first round today coming up at 4:15 Wall Street time here on Bloomberg Radio. But what do you see from a fan base? And, you know, I mean, the Tiger effect is real. I mean, watching the British Open a couple weeks ago had a totally different feel because he was in the mix. You could sense it coming through the TV.
Well, I can tell you, when he made the turn, and for 59 minutes he had the lead, and I was jumping out of my seat, I can tell you that. So that was super exciting. And yeah, the numbers are way, way up. You know, the Bridgestone last week, for example, the TV ratings, because Tiger was in the field and he was talked about, it was one of his favorite courses, and he was talked about going for his ninth win there. He didn't get it.
Right.
But still, TV ratings were a 7, where a typical PGA Tour rating is somewhere around a 3. So there he is, with that double factor going on.
What are you seeing in differences between, the U.S. consumer in golf versus the global consumer in golf?
Well, we're Japanese-based. We're Tokyo-based, and we are the number one product and brand in that market. It's a very different consumer. It's a very much more analytical consumer. So the tech story is a much more relevant pitch for us,
right,
in Japan, where here it's much more of an aspirational pitch. Mm. The pros do it, so, take a lesson from those guys.
So who do you see coming up in the ranks? I mean, Tiger is back, ooh, obviously, but who do you like this weekend?
Bryson DeChambeau.
Okay.
Yeah, he's right on the cusp of making the Ryder Cup, and he's going to have a big week at Belrive in St. Louis, and he's one of our guys, by the way.
I am not surprised to hear that. Do you find it pretty easy to, just about 30 seconds left, find it pretty easy to sign up pros these days?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we have a superior product, quite frankly. And the pros, if we had an unlimited checkbook, we'd have unlimited pros because the product's that good. That's the easy part, is the product.
Right. That's great. Well, Dan Murphy, good luck to you. Chief Executive Officer of Bridgestone Golf, based down in Covington, Georgia, but here with us in our Bloomberg 1130 studio. Do you ever get out on the links there, Carol Master?
I don't, but I did grow up going to the driving range with my dad. It's the one thing I'm jealous of my brothers, because they literally became, a certain age, and my dad started taking them out on the course.
Yeah. I played as a younger man. I'm waiting for my boys to grow up a little bit more, get them out on the golf course. And
as a younger man? What are you, 80?
Yeah, well, I'm not as young as I once was, Carol.
All right, everybody, you are listening to Bloomberg Markets with a young Jason Kelly and a young Carol Master, I might just add. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Taking care of business every day. Taking care of
So check out the cover of Bloomberg Business Week. We've got a profile of U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin with the line, "Everything is fine," behind him several times. Let's bring in Devin Leonard. He's reporter at Bloomberg Business Week. He's really been covering and writing on so many different members and possible members of President Trump's team. And this week he was tasked with writing about Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Why now, Devin?
Well, look, the guy's... Just the fact that he's lasted 18 months, you know, in a White House where, you know, 22 people have either resigned under pressure, you know, or just resigned. I mean, it's just a tumultuous place. I mean, some people would call it a snake pit. So this guy is the Treasury Secretary of the United States, somebody that people really didn't think was going to last. He had no governmental experience. And he was somebody that I think a lot of people thought, you know, was a lightweight. Some people still think he's a lightweight and say even worse things about him. But he's still there, and Trump still seems to have his back. And we'll see how long it lasts, though.
Well, and to that point, I got to read a quote. It was one of my favorite quotes in the whole story. You talked to Lloyd Blankfein, none other than Goldman CEO Lloyd Blankfein, and he says, quote, "He might not be right in the long run, but guess what? They didn't think he'd be right in the short term." No. What an amazing quote that really sums it all up. So what has been Mnuchin's secret here?
Well, I think part of his secret is that he just knows how to read his boss. He knows his boss is watching TV, looking at the newspapers, and he doesn't want to see people step out of line. So Mnuchin is being very careful not to step out of line. And also, he's gone out of his way to praise, you know, Trump in situations that, you know, other people... People like Gary Cohn, he's gone, and the guy who was running the VA, he's gone. But you know, he stood up for Trump, you know, in August, you know, after the, you know, the violent sort of rally in Charlottesville. But he's been very careful. He is pursuing his own sort of strategy. I guess you could say all these people in the White House, they're all. Share this, you know, the same, you know, policies, but the way they're all pursuing them, especially when it comes to China, and you know, in Mnuchin's case, he has a very different strategy than other people. But the question is sort of, how does he pursue it? He's a moderate without, you know, getting on the wrong side of his boss.
So the history books, Devin, are they going to say good Treasury Secretary? He set out with a mission, he got it done, or I don't know what kind of Treasury Secretary. He was mostly backing up the president. Cleaning up for the president.
Well, I think the idea is that the Treasury Secretary is supposed to have sort of some independence, from the president. When you look at the people, I think in recent history that people think are great, that there's Bob Rubin. Forget about what happened later on, with Citigroup and mm-hmm. and his bonuses and all that stuff. But when he was Treasury Secretary under Clinton, we had economic prosperity. People talked about the policies of the Clinton administration, the economic policies as Rubinomics. So, that was clearly Bob Rubin, advising Clinton, as opposed to Clinton telling him what to do. Hank Paulson, we know Bush, pretty much gave him free rein to handle, to deal with the economic crisis. And I think a lot of people think he was, he was literally, a hero, or certainly was heroic. Tim Geithner, I think is somebody who had a lot of credibility and a lot of gravitas and who Obama, really relied on. In the case, though, of Mnuchin, his boss is constantly undercutting him, and there's just a litany of examples, and really, it makes it hard for Mnuchin to do his job, and also I think ultimately he has to kind of, what's the best way of putting it? He has to do. I'll say biting his tongue. I think to stay there as Treasury Secretary in the position of Alexander Hamilton, once held.
Well, and it is interesting. One of the things you point out is, as you're going through that list of former Treasury Secretaries is, especially you think about Hank Paulson or Bob Rubin, these were known entities to Wall Street. And that is obviously a very important relationship. And while Steve Mnuchin worked at Goldman Sachs back in the day, he's not of Wall Street in the same way. I mean, he fairly quickly, went to Los Angeles. He was a hedge fund manager. Right. His father had worked at Goldman Sachs, but he did not distinguish himself in the same way that those others did. And so he doesn't have that, pun intended, sort of currency with the financial markets that maybe others. And by virtue of that, he has chosen other places to show some sort of influence, it feels like.
Well, he's been very aggressive in the use of sanctions. He obviously was very involved in the tax reform, although some people would say he sort of just discredited himself a little bit by not by pursuing tax cuts and never at least showing the outside world what the analysis was to back up, you know, his claim that the tax cuts would, you know, would pay for themselves. But and I think internationally, you know, he came in not knowing a whole lot by, you know, by his own admission. Some people internally, I guess, you know, who worked under him but have left on the international side felt he didn't show a lot of curiosity there. So, but, you know, I think on sanctions, also the FinCEN, which investigates sort of, you know, the banking industry. He's been aggressive with all that stuff. And I don't know, I think one of the issues there is that he's been pushed by Democrats because Democrats feel that maybe the Treasury knows some things about his boss.
There's a lot in this story. We got to run. Sure. I'm so sorry. I hate cutting you off.
No,
Devin Leonard,
fine.
Reporter at Bloomberg Business Week. Go to Bloomberg.com, pick up the magazine, check it out, everybody.
It's a great read.
Cover story. You are listening to Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, time for the Drive to the Close. Karen Cavanaugh is Senior Vice President and Senior Market Strategist at Voya Investment Management with us from Charleston, South Carolina, with a reminder for investors about the ABCs of investing. Great to have you back with us, Karen. Good to catch up with you
Thank
once
you.
Again. Yeah. So the ABCs, what exactly are you talking about?
Investors are bombarded with a lot of negative headlines. I mean, there's a lot about the trade wars, about the stronger dollar, about sanctions to Iran and Russia. But if you take a look at the basics, and those are the ABCs, those really guide you, and they can cut through all the noise. And those ABCs are, A is accelerating corporate earnings, and boy, are they accelerating. We're at all-time corporate highs for profits. B, broadening manufacturing, and we're seeing that manufacturing is humming along, and we're seeing good numbers in hiring and business there. And C is the consumer, because we know that the consumer is the biggest part of the U.S. economy. Consumers are strong, and the reason they're so strong is because the jobs market continues to really wow. We saw that with initial unemployment claims, very low today and yesterday, and the jobs report from a couple of days ago, which showed record high number of job openings. So those ABCs are looking very good. Then you can kind of put some of the noise on the back burner. Trade tariffs, yeah, that is worrying. But right now, companies are really getting it done, and that's the most important thing for the market.
Well, Karen, you mentioned the trade wars, and you dismissed it like we hear so many people dismissing it. Why hasn't it hit yet, or is it not going to? How do you read that? How do you model that in?
Well, I wouldn't say it's not. We have seen material prices go up, and we have seen some companies talk about it. Overall, companies are still guiding higher for the rest of the year in terms of earnings.
Right.
So I think the market is gaining some confidence in that and saying, oh, well, you know, it's not that bad. But I would say that even though we have these tariffs that are going back and forth, I don't think that we're out of the woods, because we're looking at something with China as a huge shift in the way they do business. That's not going to be easy, and that's not going to be quick. So I think that what's going on, the situation with China, is going to take some time. And I think there will be more volatility. I think we're in a period now where we're just having a great time with earnings, and we see a lot of tariff back and forth, but there's not really been any actual impact. That's not to say that we won't have some impact, and that's why investors should stay diversified and make sure they have stocks and bonds. But it's just because we've been talking about tariffs, but it hasn't really melted down into earnings.
Karen, if I may, just because we've been having a few discussions here, Jason and myself, along with our Dave Wilson, our stocks columnist, kind of about breath in the market. And Dave had an interesting start to chart today, where you talked about the S&P 500 specifically and the FANG stocks and their peers, you know, largely explaining why the S&P right now is flirting with records again, and just talking about Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google's parent Alphabet, along with Microsoft and a few others, Apple too, how they're accounting for 38% of the S&P 500's gain from the February 8th low until yesterday. And that's a lot more than I think with the previous run-up and the previous 6 months. When you look at breath, What do you see?
Well, I also see that if you take a look at the equally weighted S&P 500, that it still would be up. So maybe not up as much as it is with the FANG stocks. But remember, those FANG stocks, those high-flying growth stocks, high momentum, they have been outperforming. But investors would still be well compensated, even if they were in an equally weighted portfolio of the S&P 500. But I also tell investors, I mean, that put We saw some of these things. Hey, sometimes they go up and sometimes they go down, and we've seen that over the last couple of weeks. But if you were globally diversified, for example, small caps are up double digits. Mid caps are doing well. I think just pinning all of your investments on a particular segment of the market is risky. So I think that the markets will still be up. The equity markets in the U.S. are doing very well. And it's not just the FANG stocks, but like I said, small caps, mid caps, and even just regular S&P stocks are doing well because earnings are doing well.
All right. So, Karen,
I also just wanted to mention the consumer discretionary sector. I mean, that people wrote that one off as being, oh, it's the end of retail. And look at that's competing with tech as one of the top performers so far this year.
So what worries you then, Karen? This is a very, very optimistic view of the world.
Well, I do. I mean, obviously, I'm worried about what's going on with China because, like I said, if this is going to be a change in the way China does business, we're not saying, oh, we're going to slap some tariffs on them and things will all be better. We're saying we have to change the way business is done in China. And with trade secrets, intellectual property, that's a huge ball of wax. So that does worry me. I do worry that sometimes investors are their own worst enemy, that we have a Fed that's determined to raise rates because they want to have a little bit of firepower should things go south. Higher rates based on higher growth is not necessarily a bad thing, but sometimes investors get nervous about that. And, you know, the stronger dollar, of course, is a little bit is a headwind. But overall, I'm kind of finding it harder to put on a frown when corporate earnings are growing at 25% the first quarter, and I just looked 25% the second quarter. So I see companies continuing to guide up. So
yeah,
it's very hard to be negative
right.
when you see corporate earnings doing that. And that's why I say ABCs. The A is accelerating corporate earnings.
Right.
And when you see that, it's time to put all the other noise on the back burner. It'll show up in the earnings when things are bad.
All right. Got to run. Karen, thank you so much. Karen Cavanaugh, Senior Vice President, Senior Market Strategist at Voya Investment Management, on the phone from Charleston, South Carolina. Yeah, some optimism. We've had that from a couple of guests.
I feel like there's a lot of optimism out there, which, you know, worries me. I'm not going to lie.
Well, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of complacency in the market, I feel like. But there's also, I think, a fear of FOMO, fear of missing out.
Absolutely.
If the markets, like Jamie Dimon says, he could see the equity markets moving up, I think, for another maybe couple of years. So.
Less optimism in Tesla shares today. They are down as much as they rose on the back of that, all that drama created by Mr. Musk's tweet about going private.
Yeah, down 4.7% as we speak. Hey, folks, don't go anywhere. We've got the closing bell coming your way in just a moment. Jason Kelly, Carol Masser, right here on Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.